One of my all-time favorite coming-of-age movies, Diner, has this great scene where the main characters are crammed into a booth at a diner in Baltimore having a debate. They're high school boys, and it's 1959.
When you want to make out, who do you make out to? Sinatra or Mathis?
That's a stupid question.
One question, answer that.
It's irrelevant, I won't answer it. Mathis.
What about you, Shirley?
I'm married. We don't make out.
This scene takes place during a time when Frank Sinatra was decades into his career, but Johnny Mathis had just caught fire with three hits that made him a household name.
Chances are, 'cause I wear a silly grin the moment you come into view. Chances are you think that I'm in love with you.
Sixty years later, Johnny Mathis is still recording, still touring, and still making lovers swoon. The story behind the velvet voice on this episode of What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm Alice Winkler.
Adame, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
One night when Johnny Mathis was 19 years old, a well-known record producer came by to hear him singing at a San Francisco jazz club. Sometime into the second song, the producer, George Avakian, decided to sign Mathis on the spot. He sent a telegram back to Columbia Records' New York office. Have found phenomenal 19-year-old boy who could go all the way. Send blank contracts. We will pick up that story in a few minutes, but first, the story of what led Johnny Mathis into that club in the first place. He was born in a small Texas town, the middle child out of seven, but his father moved the family to San Francisco by the time he started school. His father is the person who first taught him how to sing.
My dad was an accomplished singer and pianist, but he played by ear. He sang because it was something that he loved to do, but he never had a career of anything, singing. But he just had a wonderful way about him that was very pleasing, very pleasant. It wasn't intimidating for me as a little kid. And from the time I was 5 or 6 years old, I was learning songs that he taught me.
Do you remember any of his songs?
Oh, sure. Just Molly and me, baby makes three. We're happy in my blue heaven.
Ah.
Yeah, and then he played the piano quite well, and he would play these wonderful, going to Kansas City, here I come. And Dad never sang about a whisper. He always whispered his songs. He was that polite, I think. I think it was just a sense of politeness about him, but he was quite good at what he did, and I learned from him, and every time I hear myself on records, I hear my dad.
If you hear a song in blue, like a flower cry for the dew, that was my heart serenading you, my prelude to a kiss.
One day, Mathis's dad brought home an old upright piano he'd found for $25, and he did whatever else he could to clear a path for his son, despite the fact that he earned very little and had six other children to feed.
You know, I think about that now, and I'm amazed because there was never a time that we didn't have what we needed. We weren't poor, we just didn't have any money. And so my mom and my dad worked as domestic workers for all their lives and supported the family that way. They were fortunate to work for people who were quite well off. So we had a lot of stuff that was given to us.
When journalist Barbara Harrison interviewed Johnny Mathis for the Academy of Achievement in 2011, he told her that his parents were two of the kindest, most supportive people he's ever known. His dad went to extraordinary lengths for him, but to be clear, he wasn't a pushy showbiz dad. He just loved music and loved that his son loved music.
My dad said, "Son, let's sing this song." And he said, "How'd you like to learn some more songs? How would you like to do this with your voice? How would you like to do that?" And that's sort of the way he treated me. And then in order to progress a little bit more, he asked me if I'd like to take voice lessons. And so we looked around San Francisco for someone to help me out. And we found a wonderful lady in Oakland. Her name was Connie Cox. And Connie taught me for about 7 years voice lessons free of charge. I would clean her apartment and run errands for her. And she was the angel. She was the one who guided me and said, "This is what I think you can do."
Connie Cox taught Johnny Mathis classical and opera singing. She wanted him to learn proper technique and protect his vocal cords so they'd last a lifetime, which they have. Johnny Mathis is 83 as I record this podcast, and he's still touring and still releasing albums, putting his signature satiny stamp with that gentle vibrato on the popular songs of the day.
And I am feeling so small. It was over my head. I know nothing at all.
Mathis has mostly sung romantic pop during his 60-plus years as a recording artist, but he's also been an interpreter of soul and R&B, show tunes, jazz, blues, country, Brazilian, even disco, not to mention Christmas music. Mathis has recorded 6 albums of Christmas songs. If you spent even a single hour in a store over the holidays, I bet you heard one of them.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up Eskimos.
When Johnny Mathis was still living under his parents' roof, taking voice lessons from Connie Cox, he says, he didn't like his voice at all.
I sounded like a little girl, and I was very disappointed because my heroes at the time were baritone singers, people like Billy Eckstine, Nat King Cole, etc.
But there was one other singer who made him certain he wanted a career using his voice, tenor or not.
There's a saying old says that love is blind. Still we're often told, seek and ye shall find. So I'm gonna seek a certain lad I've had in mind. Looking everywhere, haven't found him yet.
Lena Horne used to come through San Francisco on a regular basis and sing at this wonderful hotel, the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco, in the Venetian Room. And my dad would take me to see her. There was something electric and magnificent about her. First of all, she was gorgeous. She was a beautiful woman. And she had a history of learning her craft. She was a wonderful singer and a dancer as a youngster. And I would go and listen to her and watch her.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone.
And she would mesmerize me. And that was the thing that motivated me most, I think, to continue to perform, not just sing for recreational purposes. But I remember she was the shining light. And then I went and saw other people who became, fabulous in my mind also. But she was the one that I remember was the motivator for me. I would love to be able to be that good, have something, a quality that good. And all my life, I told her, I finally got a chance after I met her to tell her. But her husband was very kind to me, Lenny Hayton, because Lena was a little standoffish. Because she was a black woman in a white world, doing all these incredible things, making roads for people like myself. So Lena was a little bit standoffish, but her husband Lenny Hayton, who was white, used to sneak me in to her dressing room, and I'd sit out in the foyer until she was all dolled up and made up. She wouldn't see me without her makeup, of course, and put her gown on. And that was Alina Horn I always remember. I never saw her. I think maybe once I saw her off stage when she wasn't all dolled up. But of course, she was the person, I think, more so than Nat King Cole, who I almost emulated from the time I was a little kid, because he's my favorite singer. But she was this incredible person that I thought was the epitome of what it would be like to be a singing star.
In a few minutes, we'll talk a little more about race and about Johnny Mathis's experience as an African-American performer. But picking back up here with his chronology, by the time Mathis finished high school, he was just as likely to make it in sports as he was in music.
I was a high jumper and a hurdler on the track team. I also played basketball for the 130-pound team at Washington High School. And I did pretty good. I won several letters, that I still have, which are very dear to me. I was a little bit more athletically inclined as a high jumper.
And he got an athletic scholarship to study at San Francisco State, which was then a teacher's college. His plan was to become an English and phys ed teacher. On the track team, he broke San Francisco State's high jump record, and his main rival in the area was a much taller student at University of San Francisco by the name of Bill Russell, who would, of course, go on to become a legendary basketball player, not to mention the subject of another What It Takes podcast episode, which you should download after this one. But I digress. Mathis was really busy with schoolwork and track, but he was still harboring musical dreams. So when another student asked him to come jam with his jazz sextet one Sunday afternoon at a club called the Black Hawk, he said yes. This was in 1954. The club's co-owner was so smitten with Johnny Mathis's voice, she offered to become his manager. And pretty soon, she found him a regular job singing weekends at the 440 Club. That's where Columbia Records executive George Avakian, on vacation in California, heard Mathis, made him an offer, and asked him to come to New York. Mathis was just halfway through his sophomore year of college, and as fate would have it, preparing to go out for the U.S. Olympic team as a high jumper. The trials were being held at Berkeley. The very week he'd been invited to go to New York, he had a very big decision to make. Music or sports?
So I was 19 years old, and I wanted to go and join my buddies high jumping and trying out for the Olympic team, but I took one look at my dad, and he just smiled, knowing what we were going to do, and that was to go to New York and make my first recording. Dad was, you know, he was the greatest guy in the world. He would never push. He always offered and made things available for you and opened the door for me. If I wanted to go through, fine. If not, he was prepared to. Because there were many opportunities before I made my first recording to leave San Francisco with different jazz bands. And even Louis Armstrong once wanted me to go sing with him on the road. But my father looked at me and said, I don't think so. I think you should go back to school. Well, that was about the only time that that he put his foot down. But he felt that if I went to New York and made a recording and nothing really happened, I could still go back and do my schooling.
Nothing really did happen with that first album, which came out in 1956. It was a jazz album for the simple reason that George Avakian was a jazz producer and had discovered Mathis singing at a jazz club.
I think it was my choice of songs. I sang some pretty sophisticated songs when I was 18 and 19 years old because I grew up in San Francisco and I frequented the jazz clubs, and that's what I heard. I heard songs like Lush Life. You know, here I was a 19-year-old kid singing Lush Life, the most decadent song in the world, and songs that were not necessarily on the hit parade, but were standard-type songs written by some of the writers who wrote for Broadway and what have you, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, that type of thing.
You'd be so easy to love, so easy to idolize, all others above, so swell to keep every home fire burning for.
Those were the songs that that I sang, and I was fortunate enough to have my audition tape accompaniment by a guy by the name of Vince Guaraldi. Vince Guaraldi wrote the Peanuts music, the cartoon Peanuts. He wrote all that music. In fact, at Christmas time, I sang one of the songs.
Which one?
Christmas time is here. Happiness and cheer. Fun for all that children call their favorite time of year. And I love it. I got a chance to meet Charles Schulz. And those are the type of songs that I sang. They were not middle of the road. They were pretty esoteric. And George was in charge of jazz music for Columbia Records at the time. And he was looking for jazz singers all over the place. And I kind of fooled him because I hinted at being a jazz singer because those were the ones I was listening to, but I was never a jazz singer. I had to have the melody, and I wasn't good at improvising. But it brought me to his attention.
For Johnny Mathis's second album in 1957, Columbia Records took a different direction with another producer in the same building.
George Avakian was a producer. Mitch Miller was a producer. This was before they had the title producer. All they did was get the record made. And before I had a chance to leave New York and come back to San Francisco, I was heard by Mitch Miller, evidently someone at the building played one of my songs for him. He would never listen to anything jazz orientated. He was quite adamant about the fact that he didn't like jazz and he didn't like anybody who was going to sing jazz. So getting my recording to him was probably a very big stroke of luck. But somehow he heard it and he liked my voice, but he didn't like what I was singing.
Barbara,
songs like Babalu, in Spanish. The Spanish was lousy. And I'd sing, and I was accompanied by people like John Lewis of the Modern Jazz Quartet. I had a ball with all these jazz musicians for the first year and a half of my recording career. But nothing really happened to the recordings. Nobody played them, nobody listened to them, I guess. And then I met Mitch.
Mitch Miller, the same Mitch Miller, by the way, of Sing Along with Mitch fame, if you're old enough to know what I'm talking about. Mitch Miller handed Johnny Mathis a huge pile of romantic ballads to pick from for his second recording session.
And I chose a song called When Sunny Gets Blue, a song called Wonderful, Wonderful, a song called It's Not For Me to Say. And we went in the studio and recorded them. And he stood in back of me and patted me on the back while I was singing, which is very difficult to sing if somebody's patting you on the back. But he got what he wanted. I just sang the melody. I didn't improvise or try to. The first songs that I sang in that way, in that Johnny Mathis style, have been a big part of my career.
It's not for me to say you love me. It's not for me to say you'll always care.
I had outlived my Lena Horne impressions and my Nat King Cole impressions and my Billy Eckstein impressions, and he wouldn't have any of that. He wanted me just to sing, so in a way which I thought wasn't exciting enough. Didn't have any fire. I said, anybody can do that. He said, that's it. I want you to sing like anybody can do it and make sure that everybody thinks that they can sing like that. And I didn't understand what he was saying. But about a year later, we had some success with, I think, Wonderful, Wonderful.
Sometimes we walk hand in hand by the sea and we breathe in the cool, salty air. Turn to me with a kiss in your eyes, and my heart feels a thrill beyond compare. Then your lips cling to mine. It's wonderful, wonderful. Oh, so wonderful, my love.
Sometimes for reasons I don't completely understand, Johnny Mathis's first big hits were released as singles, but they weren't included on his second album. That album was even called Wonderful, Wonderful, although it didn't contain the song. So for album number 3, Mitch Miller had the idea to put those hit singles together with some B-side songs. He called the LP Johnny's Greatest Hits, and here's some trivia to try out on your friends. It was the very first Greatest Hits album. The concept just didn't exist before that. Of course, greatest hits albums, as we know them now, are made for artists with way more than 2 albums under their belts. But the next bit of trivia is even more impressive. That Johnny Mathis greatest hits album spent 10 years on the Billboard chart. 10 years.
I was very fortunate because Columbia Records and CBS television were entwined in those days. So whenever I had a record release on Columbia, they would put me on the Ed Sullivan Show, and I would go nationally to the rest of the world, or the rest of the United States, singing my song. So that's how I became, you know, immensely popular very, very early on in my career because of the Ed Sullivan Show.
I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud. I can't understand, I get misty just holding your hand.
Now, there's a strange thing about Johnny Mathis's early success. His fans, who were mostly white, were often surprised to discover that he was African-American, even though he's pretty clearly a person of color. As he told the New Yorker magazine, "When I first recorded, everyone thought I was white because I didn't sound like whatever people think black people sound like. And then when Columbia started to put my face on album covers, people still couldn't figure it out. And it never occurred to me to tell people about my racial mixture because it wouldn't help my singing, and that's all I was interested in." Mathis is pretty certain he has some Choctaw Indian and white ancestry in that mix, which may account for his fine, wavy hair. But he says that being African American in his diverse San Francisco neighborhood never caused him any problems growing up. And in this interview, as in others, he really doesn't seem that interested in talking about race or politics. He did participate in one concert in Alabama in 1963 to raise money for the March on Washington, but he generally refuses any credit for helping break through the color barrier.
I was so fortunate. I followed people like Lena Horne, Billy Eckstein, Nat King Cole, and icons in the music business when I was growing up. And eventually, I got to meet all of them and even become close friends with them. But they're the ones who did all the work for me as far as race relations were concerned. And fortunately, they were all intelligent, bright people who were looking to improve the relationships between black entertainers and white entertainers and just the, you know, in general, the public as a whole. So what I had done is really just, you know, just float in after them. But I always made sure that I kept the dignity, or tried to keep the dignity that they showed, by standing there and singing and not doing too much else, because I didn't know what else to do. But, you know, sometimes you can get carried away and I don't know, lose your composure or something. But I was very conscious of that. I said, all I'm going to do is sing. I'll be out of here in a minute. You guys just enjoy. I'll sing my hit songs. And that's kind of the way I thought about it. But then, of course, the natural kind of intellect that you have comes into being, and I realized that, you know, what they were people, you know, who were ignorant of the fact that we were all doing the same thing. I mean, come on, you know, just the skin color's a little different. And I said, what's the big deal? And then, of course, before I knew it, things got better. So I had good role models to follow, but they were the ones who went to the nightclubs and to the concert halls before me and paved the way. And when I came along, I really was judged by my music and nothing more.
It's true that Johnny Mathis, by the time he was 25, was one of the highest paid performers in the country. And he was selling out the Sands Hotel in Vegas like his heroes before him. But there's a bit more to the story of what hurdles he faced than he at first lets on.
The only thing I thought was amusing, and then I got a little mad about it after I kind of thought about it, was that I couldn't stay at the hotel. I had to stay at some other place. And I thought, well, you know, I'll take the money and run or something. I don't know. I was a little annoyed later on. But then, of course, I realized how important these entertainers who had gone before were to my life. And fortunately, over the years, as I mentioned, I think before, I had a chance to meet them all. Lena Horneck and Cole, Bill Eckstein, and even Duke Ellington and Count Basie, and all the great black entertainers who had gone before. And I actually sat down and told them how proud I was of them and what they had done and how easy they made it for me. Because not only do they make it easy for me, but the laws of the country changed. They changed the laws. So they would have had to answer to deny me my right to stay at the hotel or stay anywhere I wanted to.
It was many, many years, though, before the laws would protect his rights as a gay man. Johnny Mathis says as a teenager, he accepted his own sexuality, again, growing up in San Francisco, and his parents accepted it too. But it was a career liability back then, so he stayed closeted until the early 80s when he came out to a magazine reporter thinking he was speaking off the record. He got death threats after the article appeared, but these days he's sanguine about his life and has some regret that he kept the secret for so long. He's also open about another struggle in his life.
I worked very hard from the time I was a young kid, and I've really and truly been focused. The only time I've gotten out of focus is when I've gotten afraid that I couldn't do what people expected me to do. That's a little frightening. And then I've done some things that were not productive, nothing earth-shattering, but, you know, I got off the track there a couple of times.
The first time, Mathis was doing 5 shows a night at the Copacabana in New York when he developed laryngitis. Everyone told him to see a German doctor who had a lot of Broadway stars as patients. That infamous doctor, Max Jacobson, claimed that his injections were a miracle tissue generator, but they contained amphetamines, and Johnny Mathis got addicted. He was about 25.
And that was tough to deal with, because when I didn't sing, I wouldn't take the medication. I wouldn't take the medication that he gave me. So I would have withdrawals, and I ended up in the hospital. But fortunately, I understood how devastating it was for me. And it took me, I don't know, maybe a month or two to get that out of my life. And then I also went through Alcoholics Anonymous because I thought I was drinking too much, and I thought it was I was embarrassed. But I had people who loved me and said, "Well, don't be embarrassed. Do something about it." I said, "Well, what'll I do?" And they said, "Do this." And they sent me to people who helped me and got me off the booze and. Maybe the only things that really could have ruined me, but it was when you're doing bad things, you just don't know whether you can conquer them or not, and I found out how strong I could be when I was motivated, and I'm kind of proud of that.
For all that Johnny Mathis has to be proud of, he says his very success fills him with a sense of humility.
Absolutely. Most of the inspiration and teachings that I've had over the years were by people, very humble people who are grateful for any success. Because let's face it, you're competing with the world. And to be given an opportunity to do what I've done is in fact a miracle. It's the most extraordinary thing that ever happened. I am I am still the child that I was when I was high jumping and hurdling, and I still feel awe and inspired by the people that I first heard sing, and also music has been my life. I've met people like Leontine Price and Beverly Sills and Richard Tucker and Luciano Pavarotti, and those are the voices of, you know, of the ages, and yet they embraced me and took me in as one of their own, and it's the most amazing thing that ever happened. I still think I'm dreaming.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch the sky. I think about it every night and day. Spread my wings and fly away. I believe I can soar.
It's a dream he continues to have as his career enters its seventh decade. And through all those years, at no point has he felt he's reached the pinnacle. It's probably why he's able to keep going. That and some vocal cords that just won't quit. But there are always new songs to sing and new goals, he says. Once, when he was 50, for instance, he remembers being inspired by some of his icons a generation older who were still performing.
I remember it vividly. I was watching them on Broadway and some productions that they were doing. And I said, when I get to be 72, I would like to perform that well and have my ability still intact. And when I was 72, I remember I took note of where I was, what I was doing, and I said, okay, everything's all right. Now what do I do? I've done sort of the thing that I kind of had my eye on, and I said, I want to see if I can do what I admired about them and maybe blaze a few trails and do something at a later age that maybe will inspire someone else. I don't feel old, except, you know, in the morning once in a while when I can't turn over properly and say, what's that? When did that happen? Our brain doesn't accept that. We're geared to last.
Last and last and last in the case of Johnny Mathis. A decade from now, when he's 93, it won't surprise me at all if he's still touring, going strong. And thanks to vinyl and MP3s, he may just be the voice of romance forever.
It's wonderful to be involved in something that captures your life from almost the beginning to the end. It's just, I'm absolutely blessed.
Johnny Mathis was inducted into the Academy of Achievement in 2011 and into the Grammy Hall of Fame three times for Misty, It's Not For Me To Say, and Chances Are. He's also the recipient of the Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award. In 2017, San Francisco State University gave him an honorary doctorate in fine arts, 60 years after he dropped out to pursue a career in music. His alma mater is also home to the annual Johnny Mathis Invitational Track and Field Meet. And although Mathis was a high school jumper in his youth, he's the endurance athlete of the music world, the longest running artist on the Columbia Records label. If you're a true Mathis maniac, you can buy the new Columbia box set with 68 CDs in it. We'll go out on one of his own favorite recordings, When I Fall in Love. I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes from the Academy of Achievement.
In a restless world like this is, love is ended before it's begun, and too many moonlight kisses seem to cool in the warmth of the sun.
What It Takes is funded by the Catherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening and singing along.
It will be completely, or I'll never, ever give my heart. And the moment I can feel fall in love is when